Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for Spirit, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Director of Community Programs for the Orthodox Union, and it's my honor to coordinate and host this program. The OU created Spirit several years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it in a virtual setting for baby boomers, active retirees, not yet retirees, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents, and seniors. Everybody who's looking for opportunities for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Since everybody still continues to shelter in because of the pandemic, Spirit has become the perfect way for everybody to engage in an online setting. The Spirit program has recently become acquainted with the educational outreach efforts of Weill Cornell Medicine from New York Presbyterian Hospital of Queens. Over the next few months, we will be hearing from some of their experts on various health matters that affect our Spirit demographic. Today, we'll be addressing the very important issue of breast cancer, and we're honored to have a presentation by Dr. Lauren Alreda, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Department of Hematology and Oncology from Weill Cornell Medicine of New York Presbyterian of Queens. It's my privilege to welcome Dr. Alreda to the Spirit Forum and turn the program over to her.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Judy, for the introduction. And as you know, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and I felt that it would be appropriate to have a talk about breast cancer, give an overview in 2020, what we've done and where we are now. So as per the American Cancer Society, the estimated new cancer cases in the United States in 2020, unfortunately, are approaching close to 2 million cases a year. And as you can see on this graph, men lead with prostate cancer being the number one diagnosis, and breast in females, followed by lung in both groups. The lifetime probability of developing cancer for females, specifically in all sites, is 1 in 3. But when you look at breast specifically, it is 1 in 8, which is still pretty high. However, you know, the trends in 5-year relative survival rates have improved over the decades. And as you can see, in the mid-70s, in female breast cancers, the rate of 5-year survival was at 75% for all stages and has improved throughout the decades. And now close to 2016, the last reported survival rates at 91% at 5 years. And obviously now, as we are performing more individualized and personalized therapies, these numbers should continue to increase. The estimated deaths for cancer in the United States are still quite high. Over 500,000 people are still dying of cancer in the United States in 2020. Again, lung is the number one killer in both males and females. But again, as you know, breast follows lung in 15% of these cases, estimating a 42,000 women who are dying and men of breast cancer in the United States in 2020. So we still have a lot of work to do in getting this number down. So what is breast cancer? Breast cancer is not just one disease. There are different types of breast cancer, which we'll talk about in later slides. And it occurs when the breast cells that line the ducts or the lobules become malignant. Malignant tumors are made up of abnormal cells that grow with normal controls and invade the normal breast tissue. This is a schematic of the breast, a cross-sectional view. As you can see on the outside is the skin followed by the fatty tissue. And inside, deep within the breast, we see the lobules of the breast. These are the glands that produce milk. And then the milk is then moved out through the ducts of the breast. These are the two most common areas where breast cancer can occur. And if you look closely, you can see the veins and arteries that penetrate the breast, bringing blood into the breast and out of the breast. And in conjunction, nearby, you'll see closed lymphatics nearby the circulation that carry our immune cells and that are responsible for filtering the blood and fighting infection, cancer, and inflammation. So when a woman develops breast cancer, we worry that the breast cells can invade into the circulation and through these lymphatics. So part of our workup is to identify the pattern of spread. Now, before we go into all of that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the breast cancer risk factors. And there are a lot of risk factors for breast cancer. Obviously, one of them is getting older. The older we get, the more susceptible we are to developing mutations that make us more vulnerable to developing different types of cancers. A personal history of ovarian cancer or breast cancer increases the risk. Having a first-degree relative, such as a mother, daughter, or sister who has had breast cancer also increases the risk. Having a previous breast biopsy that has shown a precancerous lesion, a high-risk lesion like hyperplasia or carcinoma in situ increases your risk. Early menarche, meaning you have a period onset of probably less than 12 years of age. The earlier a girl gets her period, the more exposure she has to endogenous estrogens, which also have a higher risk for development of breast cancer. Same for women who go through late menopause. Women are then have a longer reproductive cycle and have repeated exposure to endogenous estrogens. So these are types of questions we ask women when we see them for a consultation. Having an inherited mutation in BRCA1 and BRCA2, which I'll go into a little bit more in detail, is very important and presents the highest risk of breast cancer development. Being nulliparous or never having children also presents a higher risk because these women are exposed to a longer reproductive cycle, endogenous estrogen exposure. And we know that women who get pregnant and have children usually will drop their levels of estrogen postpartum and remain lower than a nulliparous woman. Not breastfeeding also increases the risk because we do know when women breastfeed, the estrogen levels do come down. Taking birth control, most of the birth controls that we talk about are estrogen and progesterone based. So again, the stimulus being the hormones for five or more years. Combined estrogen and progesterone hormonal replacement therapy, this is not as utilized these days anymore. We used to give hormone replacement therapy to women with severe menopausal symptoms, and we've learned over time that replacing these hormones has increased the risk for ovarian, breast, and other reproductive cancers. Having dense breasts also increases the risk because we know that women with dense breasts also have fatty tissue that is increased in their breasts that holds more estrogen, and increased alcohol and obesity also have been correlated. What about the mutations? The breast cancer mutations, BRCA1 and BRCA2, are the most notable mutations in breast cancer that we look for. BRCA1 was discovered in 1995 and BRCA2 was discovered in 1996. It's present in less than 1% of the population, and it accounts for approximately 5 to 10% of all breast cancers. So we also have to realize that most of the women that present to us are not mutation carriers. They are spontaneous breast cancers that have arisen for other reasons, which we'll talk about later. Women carrying these mutations, however, do have a lifetime risk of developing breast cancer of up to 80%. There are three common mutations that are seen in the Ashkenazi Jewish woman population. We know that the risk in this particular population is higher, 1 in 40 chance of developing breast cancer. There are one deletion and one insertion in BRCA1 that can be found, and a third deletion in BRCA2, making it placing them at a higher risk of developing breast cancer. The mutations together yield 2 to 3% mutation carrier prevalence among the U.S. Ashkenazi Jewish population. And what's interesting is that in the BRCA1 cohort, we see a high prevalence of this mutation in Hispanic population as well. There are other genes that are associated with the increased risk of breast cancer, some of which I've listed here. These genes are responsible for other ailments, but we do test these genes in a genetic panel when we think the patient needs to have genetic testing. So we do include a variety of genes, and now we're testing hundreds of genes, but these are just some of the genes that people should be aware of when they are diagnosed with breast cancer, especially if they have a family history. And as you can see here, just to point out, BRCA1 and BRCA2 leads in the highest risk of breast cancer if it's found in a patient. So when do we offer genetic testing? Well, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network recommends genetic testing to be offered. One, when we know that the individual has a family history of a known BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation. If the patient has a personal history of breast cancer, plus one of the following, they are diagnosed at a young age, less than 45, or they are diagnosed less than the age of 50 and have one or more close blood relatives with breast cancer at any age, or have a family member with pancreas cancer, prostate cancer, or we are not able to identify a complete family history. Patients who are diagnosed with something called triple negative breast cancer and are under the age of 60 should also receive genetic testing. And we'll go over what triple negative breast cancer is later. Other patients who should be tested are those who have two or more close blood relatives with breast, pancreatic, or prostate cancer at any age, one or more close blood relative with breast cancer over the age of 50, more than one close blood relative with ovarian cancer, a close male relative with breast cancer, or a personal history of ovarian, fallopian tube, or primary peritoneal cancer. We also have to address the fact that men can get breast cancer too. And male breast cancer is rare, but we do in fact have male breast cancer patients which we are treating. And the warning signs are very similar to the signs that a woman would present with, which includes a lump, nipple discharge, reddening, inversion of the nipple, or skin dimpling. We know that the breast cancer factors for men correlate with some of the same risk factors that I've talked about previously for women. I also want to highlight that BRCA1 and BRCA2 can be found in male breast cancer patients. There are hereditary syndromes like such as Klinefelter's disease, which is where a male acquires an extra X chromosome, which puts them at risk for breast cancer development. Diet and fitness, obesity, for example, consumption of alcohol, also similar in males as a risk factor. Exposure to occupational toxins and radiation as well is a risk factor. And patients with cirrhosis, I have to point out, patients who have liver disease are tend to make higher estrogen and there are higher estrogen levels in the system, which can then stimulate breast cancer development. So there are three tiers of early detection. And I think one of the most important things is education and becoming aware of breast cancer and how to screen for it. And we know that if we do these things, which includes education about self-breast exam, going for a clinical exam and mammography when indicated, that early detection equals better outcomes. So some of the breast screening investigations include a self-breast exam, which I'll show you a picture of on the next slide. Teaching women how to examine their breast or men how to examine their breast is really crucial in identifying breast cancers early on. We teach patients to get to know how their breasts feel so that if something appears that wasn't there before, they are able to bring it to our attention sooner rather than later so that we can work it up. A clinical breast exam is usually done by a doctor or nurse practitioner, and it is a safety net. You know, if the patient's not catching something, it may be the doctor or the NP will, and that gives us another extra layer of you know, examination. Mammography, as we all know, is the screening modality that we use for detection of breast cancer. It's not always sensitive to picking up cancers, especially in women who have dense breasts. And so we may have to resort to other screening modalities such as MRI and ultrasound screening in order to get a better assessment in particularly young patients or patients with dense breasts. Now, digital versus screening mammography, we've shied away more from the screen film mammography, which is the older type, and now we are doing digital 3D mammography, which gives us a 3D view of the breast and enables the radiologist to capture abnormalities that we would not otherwise capture on a screen film mammography. So this is a schematic of a self-breast exam, and one way that we teach women to do this is either lying down and checking their breast, or standing up in the shower and checking their breast, and you know, putting their fingers together closely together and gently probing each breast in each of these three patterns, moving from the top down towards the nipple, basically coming towards the areola, or going up and down the breast on each side, or in a circular fashion to make sure that you've tapped into all areas of the breast and identifying anything that doesn't feel normal. And usually these types of masses, if they are big enough, can be palpated on clinical exam or self-exam and are usually felt to be hard, sometimes immobile, they don't move, usually are painless. However, we have had patients who've had painful lumps as well. So clinical breast exam, again, is the doctor and the patient coming together to assess for lumps and physical changes. If a patient is feeling something that they haven't felt before, and bring it to the doctor's attention so that they can also examine the patient and feel the area of concern. And obviously any palpable abnormality in the breast should be sent for further investigation to make sure that this is not a malignant lesion. So again, our goal is for early detection. So educating our patients about doing these things at home and bringing it to our attention as soon as they find something is really important. Signs and symptoms of breast cancer. So we know that the lump in the breast is what we talk about, but there are other things that can arise in the breast or changes in the breast that may be of concern and bring it to the provider's attention. If you're feeling something in the breast, such as a hard mass or a lump in the axilla, then that's of concern and should be brought to attention of a clinician. If there's a change in the appearance of the breast, the contour of the breast, it's not looking symmetrical, this is a concerning feature and should be brought to our attention. If we see discharge from the nipple or bleeding from the nipple, it also should be worked up. Or we see that there is skin changes, there's darkening of the skin or an orange appearance of the skin or redness of the skin, dimpling of the skin. These are changes that could reflect an inflammatory breast cancer. So if there are any changes to the skin, even without a palpable lump, it should be brought to the doctor's attention for further examination. And lastly, if there is inversion of the nipple, even if there isn't a palpable mass or a skin lesion, that also should be brought to the doctor's attention for further workup. So we know that screening mammography helps and has decreased the risk of deaths from breast cancer. And in the United States, we go through the guidelines from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the American College of Radiology, and the Comprehensive Cancer Network, where we recommend that mammography screening starts at the age of 40. And obviously for patients who are higher risk, this is probably going to be starting earlier than 40. But some of the debates that we have is when to stop mammography. And oftentimes, age is not really the reason why we should stop. We should be looking at life expectancy. And, in most cases, if a patient is otherwise healthy, we continue mammography screening. If they are older and have comorbidities and a life expectancy of 5 to 7 years, we may consider stopping the screening mammography. And we recommend that screening mammography be done annually. So I'd like to move on to breast cancer stage. And as you know, breast cancer is divided into five stages. Stage zero has an excellent prognosis and is 100% survival rate. And we have stage one, again, early stage, excellent prognosis, a survival rate of 98%. Stage two, three, and four. And I'll talk about a little bit what the differences are. Stage zero is carcinoma in situ. That means that they are cancer cells that have developed within the ducts of the breast or the lobules of the breast that have not yet broken out and penetrated into the adjacent tissue. These are the earliest breast cancer lesions that we find and oftentimes treated with surgery and no need for further medical therapy, but could require radiation depending on what kind of surgery you have had done. Stage one cancer is an early stage breast cancer that has invaded the surrounding tissue, but it has not gone into the lymphatics. Stage two is when it has invaded into the surrounding tissue and may be involved in up to 1 to 3 lymph nodes. Stage three is when it's invaded the lymphatics and has involved more than 4 lymph nodes. And stage four means that the breast cancer cells have traveled to other areas of the body, which may include the lungs, the liver, the bone, or the brain. And as you can see, the more advanced stage the patient presents with, the survival rate does decrease. How does breast cancer spread? It spreads through the tissue, it spreads through the lymph system, and it also spreads through the blood. And we talked about that in the earlier slide with the breast cross-section. Now, there are different types of breast cancer, as we mentioned in the beginning of the talk. We have the non-invasive lesions, which we just talked about, which are carcinoma in situ. They can start in the lobules of the breast, or they can start in the ducts of the breast. And these are the lesions that are stage zero typically and are usually surgically removed and have an excellent prognosis. When breast cancer tends to be invasive, again, it's categorized into two main types, ductal and lobular. And depending on where it's traveled, we would stage it. And we have other types of breast cancers, which include Paget's disease of the nipple and areola, which is a breast cancer that involves the skin and it get the orange dimpling, they present with orange dimpling of the skin and sometimes pruritus. And inflammatory breast cancer is usually involving the skin, red and inflamed. And these patients tend to need systemic management fairly quickly to get it under control. And also male breast cancer because it is rare. So what do we need to do? We need to do a palpation, which is a self-breast exam, followed up with radiology and biopsy if we are suspicious that there is a cancer there. So all breast cancers can be grouped into 3 categories. The main category of breast cancers, or the most common type, is a hormone-positive breast cancer, and up to 75% of women will present with this type of cancer. It can be ductal or it could be lobular. Hormone-positive breast cancer, and we'll go into what that is primarily a breast cancer that is driven by estrogen or progesterone. As you can see here, progesterone receptor positive, estrogen receptor positive. Then we have a group of categories of up to 15 to 20% of patients will present with something called HER2-positive breast cancer, which I'll also talk about. And these patients can be hormone positive or they can be hormone negative, but because of this HER2 positivity, they are treated a little bit differently than our main category. And lastly, we have 15% of our patients presenting with triple negative breast cancer, which is a breast cancer that does not express estrogen or progesterone receptors, and it does not express HER2 protein. So if we further divide the breast cancer subtypes in all cases, we have the hormone positive group, we have the hormone negative group. And if you divide the hormone positive group into it further, you will have the hormone positive group that is HER2 negative. This is the most common type that we see. And then we have our triple positives that have estrogen, progesterone, and HER2. Again, this encompasses 10% of the cases. And in our hormone negative group, we have patients who are hormone negative, HER2 positive. This is the least common of all. These patients usually receive therapy directed at HER2 plus chemotherapy, and we'll talk about that later. And lastly, triple negatives, where they don't have any of these expressed, 13% of all cases. Now, before we move on to treatment, I wanted to touch about breast cancer in the elderly. We do have, Queens is one of our, is the most diverse county in New York City, and we do have an elderly population here, and we do see elderly breast cancer. And we want to make mention that age is not the only factor we look at, and it shouldn't be the only factor. We have to take into account the patient's comorbidities and other things that are going on with the patient in order to make the best assessment on how they treat their breast cancer. So we know that in breast cancer in elderly patients, there are favorable features. And compared to younger patients, the tumors in elderly tend to be smaller. There's less nodal involvement. They are usually hormone driven, and they are not HER2 positive, and they're usually low grade. So more indolent, more manageable tumors, so they can still undergo surgical management or hormonal manipulation depending on the stage of the patient. Unfavorable features would be a life expectancy that is short. We must weigh the life expectancy and treatment benefits, especially if it's an aggressive disease or an advanced stage. We have to take into account their comorbidities, and the presence of their comorbidities will tend to independently increase cancer mortality, meaning that if they have a heart issue or they're on dialysis, it may be very difficult to treat them for their cancer, and therefore their mortality increases. And obviously frailty can adversely affect the treatment outcome and decrease overall survival. So treatment for breast cancer, there are five standard options. Obviously, we all know that surgery is part of the treatment paradigm for breast cancer management. We will talk about that. Radiation therapy, hormone therapy, chemotherapy, and targeted therapy. So surgical treatment options are two main treatment options, which is a lumpectomy, which you see on the top left. This is when the portion of the breast where the abnormality is removed. And what are the benefits of this? Well, it's less extensive surgery. Women will have breast conservation and keep their natural breast. And the recovery is shorter, sometimes from a few days to 2 weeks, depending on whether or not they needed to have their lymph nodes removed. But we also know that in patients who elect breast conservation therapy with lumpectomy, we usually will follow this up with radiation therapy. It's routinely done in younger patients. It's debatable in patients over 70. But the reason why radiation is needed is because the breast tissue is still present, and the majority of the breast is still present, and we want to reduce the risk of local recurrence in the breast. And radiation is used as a modality to do this, and it usually decreases the risk of local recurrence by 40%. On the other hand, mastectomy is also an option, which is removal of the entire breast. It's a major operation. It takes an average of 4 to 8 weeks to recover, depending on the extent of the surgery, lymph node removal, and whether or not breast reconstruction was performed at the same time. Radiation can still be needed even after a mastectomy, depending on the tumor size and how, if the lymph nodes were involved. And obviously the possibility of local recurrence will be low since the breast has been removed. Now, sometimes breast conservation therapy cannot be an option. And the reason being is that for several things. One is that a patient may have a very large tumor, and it would be very hard to remove that completely without undergoing medical treatment to reduce the size of the tumor first. And this is something called neoadjuvant chemotherapy in breast cancer. So oftentimes it's a multidisciplinary conference between medical oncologists, surgical oncologists, radiation oncologists to define who are the patients that would benefit from neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And getting chemotherapy before surgery to shrink their tumors to allow for a better surgical outcome. Patients with smaller breasts and large tumors are candidates for this. Patients will have very large tumors that may have extended into the axilla and have nodal involvement, and we want to debulk the area before surgery. And patients who really do want to try for breast conservation therapy to try and shrink their tumor and avoid a mastectomy. So the advantage is to reduce the tumor burden, to downstage the axilla and make sure that the nodal disease is under control. We want to assess how the tumor responds to chemotherapy. It gives us a lot of information about the biology of the tumor. And in those who have a complete response, tend to do better and have overall better outcomes. So this is a good way of really assessing patients prognostically. So what is hormone positive breast cancer? We talked a little bit about this before. Hormone positive breast cancer is a breast cancer that has an expression of estrogen and progesterone receptors. In this schematic on the left, you could see that the estrogen receptor binds estrogen. And when it binds estrogen, it signals the cell to continue to divide. So it's almost like a feeding mechanism or a stimulus for the cancer to grow. And we do have therapies now, and more than one, where we have hormonal blockade, and this basically will bind to the receptor so that the hormone cannot bind and therefore stimulate the cancer to grow. Sometimes it's not just hormonally driven. It could be a combination of hormone stimulus plus spontaneous mutations. And on the slide on the right, you can see that we have hormonal stimulation to these normal breast cells, which make them cancerous. But there also could be a mistake in the DNA, and the immune system does not correct it, or our DNA repair mechanisms do not correct it. And so you can have not only a hormone stimulus, but a mutational defect as well. And we try to identify where these stimuluses are coming from or what defects the patient has. In estrogen receptor negative breast cancers, we do not have that estrogen or progesterone stimulus. So we know that the cell proliferation is not controlled by estrogen, and we cannot use estrogen inhibitors to help these patients. And so we need to dig deeper as to whether or not they have other types of receptors present or mutations that we can target. So in hormone positive breast cancer, the landscape has changed. In the past, anyone with a breast cancer that we felt was high risk for recurrence received chemotherapy. But nowadays in hormone positive breast cancer, especially if they are node negative, meaning they do not have cancer that has been passed on to their lymph nodes, can qualify for a genetic panel on their tumor, which means that we assess the genes that are expressed in the tumor to allow us to understand, do these women need chemotherapy or can they just go on to hormonal blockade? This is called the Oncotype DX assay. And this DX assay basically has 21 cancer-related genes, five of which are reference genes, that we look for in the tumor itself. And when we assess the tumor, it gives us, for these genes, it gives us a score for that individual patient. So this is a form of individualized therapy for each and every patient that comes in with a hormone-positive breast cancer who has not had lymph node involvement. And it lets us know, what do we do next? Do we need to do chemotherapy or can we just do hormonal blockade? This is a slide that represents a sample score of a patient. And as you can see here, the score is reported on the left-hand side, which is called the recurrence score. This score tells us a lot. It tells us, is the patient at risk for systemic recurrence in the future? It tells us whether or not they need chemotherapy. If you see, I don't know if you could see this, but on the bottom here, it divides the patient group into age over 50 and age younger than 50. And it will tell us, based on their score, will they benefit from chemotherapy? Now, this particular patient, as you can see here on the far right, the absolute chemotherapy benefit based on their tumor genetics is less than 1%. And the distant recurrence risk at 9 years is estimated at 3%, which is very low. So we know in this particular patient, that they will not benefit from chemotherapy. In actuality, it would just do more harm than good because of all of the toxicities that they would have to go through, and that hormonal blockade is sufficient. So moving forward to HER2-positive breast cancer, I just wanted to put in a slide about what this is. HER2-positive breast cancer is a breast cancer that is driven by something called HER2-new, which is a protein that is usually found on normal breast cells. It is also found in other areas of the body, which line our GI tract, usually the stomach and the colon as well. And this protein is responsible for signal transduction to the nucleus, which is the powerhouse of the cell, that basically will make the determination as to whether or not it should replicate and grow and divide. Now, in patients with HER2-positive breast cancer, the defect is that they have overexpression of this protein. They have too much of it. And this causes dysregulation of the activation of the receptor. So they are activated, and it causes kind of a chaotic signal downstream to the nucleus, which then tells the cell, keep dividing, keep growing, keep dividing. And this is a cancer HER2-positive cell. So in this type of breast cancer, we know that we need to do something to block this dysregulation so that the cell stops the stimulus to replicate. So what do we have to do this? Well, we have many agents now, but the first agent approved in 2000 was something called trastuzumab or Herceptin, which is a monoclonal antibody that is used to block the ligand binding to HER2. The ligand, which is the epidermal growth factor, is basically what binds to the HER2 protein and signals the cell to grow and for that cancer cell to survive. We now have this, we have many medications, but one of which is trastuzumab, which we still use in present day for HER2 positive patients, which comes and binds to the HER2 protein. So it does not allow this ligand to stimulate it, and therefore there isn't any signaling for the cancer cell to grow, which causes cancer cell death. Now, triple negative breast cancer is basically a cancer that is hard to target. And as you can see in the first slide here, a patient can have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, progesterone receptor positive breast cancer, or HER2 positive breast cancer. But in a triple negative cancer, we do not have any of these targets. So we cannot use hormonal inhibition. We cannot use Herceptin against the HER2 protein. So it becomes a challenge in treating these patients. This is a slide that looks at the percentage of triple negative breast cancers among total breast cancers diagnosed in women in each group. So if we look at the non-Hispanic Black population, 21% of these women are presenting with triple negative breast cancers. In our American Indian and Alaska Native population, 12% are triple negative breast cancers. Hispanic Latino, 12%. Asian and Pacific Islander, 10%. And our non-Hispanic white population, 10%. So again, it's not the majority, but in our African-American patients here, we do see a higher tendency to present with triple negative breast cancer. So what are the future aspects and what are the strategies that we can use to treat patients with triple negative breast cancer? And there's a lot of research going on now looking at different ways besides chemotherapy, because that's what we have, to target triple negative breast cancers. And so we are looking at whether or not the patient has a BRCA mutation, because we do have medications now that target BRCA mutations. We're looking at whether or not the patient is sensitive to immunotherapy, which is a newer form of therapy for many solid tumors, including breast cancer, especially in the triple negative population. We are looking for other pathways within the cell that could be mutated that we can develop drugs for in order to stop the proliferation of cancer, and really redefining and refining our conventional chemotherapy, intensifying some of the agents that we have now, and studying which could be more effective. So a lot at play here for triple negative breast cancer, very exciting time for these patients. And you know, every day we are seeing progress in getting these patients the treatment that they need. So what's on the horizon for breast cancer? Many things are on the horizon, and thankfully so. Besides chemotherapy and radiation therapy, we are looking at multiple ways to control the tumor environment or change the tumor environment of the breast cancer, which means that we don't want it to thrive. So anything that is contributing to its growth and to it thriving and spreading, we want to try and control and stop. And a lot of these that are here on this page represent different types of therapies that we are looking into now, some of which we already have and established and are being used. So I'm gonna present a couple of those slides. This slide is a really nice representative of where we are and more. And as you can see here, this is a cell, okay? And we've talked about the estrogen receptor being expressed. So we know we have some agents now like tamoxifen and the aromatase inhibitors, which are medications that are used in menopausal women to block estrogens. Fulvestrant, also an estrogen blockade. We have these agents and we've had them for a long time and we still use them. And they are very effective in controlling breast cancer. So we do have a mechanism there. We are also learning about other pathways within the cells that are relevant now to breast cancer. One of them is called the cyclin D pathway, which is responsible for this protein here right in the center, CDK4/6. And we've been identifying that this is a pathway that is important in breast cancer, especially in hormone positive disease, and is a site of target. And we already have 3 FDA approved medications to block this target. And this is usually used in a first line hormone positive advanced metastatic breast cancer. And we hope to bring these drugs into the adjuvant setting, meaning patients who are cured with surgery and radiation, and then maybe looking at these drugs as a maintenance to protect them from recurrence to advanced disease in the future. There are also other targets called the P13K, which we have a drug for. We can test for this mutation. We can test for the mTOR mutation, which we also have a medication for. And we also have here on the left, the MEK and RAF mutations. Again, so more and more data coming out about different targets that we can identify and try to use targeted therapy for. Again, this is mostly in the advanced stage setting, and we're looking at, you know, whether or not these agents can be used earlier on. So what about patients who have BRCA mutations? What about them? Well, we know that there are the BRCA gene is the BRCA 1 and 2 are usually there and to function to repair daily DNA damage. And if they are there and they function, it allows the cells to grow in a healthy way. If we have too much DNA damage, then you know they are there to help pull us out of that and cause cell death so that cell does not grow into a cancer cell. Now, what if you have the mutation? Well, if you look at this slide, if you could see this clearly, and I apologize if it's a little bit fuzzy, if the BRCA mutation is responsible for that normal DNA repair on a daily basis, and now it's mutated, then the only other protein that is around is called PARP. PARP is also there to do the same job. And it basically is in overdrive. And we then are having, we will use inhibitors to PARP to prevent DNA repair in cancer cells. So this will increase cancer cell death and, sorry, I'm not seeing my slide. And it also may help chemotherapy and radiation work better. So if BRCA 1 and 2 is damaged or not working, the cell is dependent on PARP for all of its DNA repair. And in that case, PARP inhibitors will prevent the DNA repair in these cancer cells. We do not want the cancer cells to repair their DNA, because if they repair their DNA, they're going to be alive and they're going to thrive. So we want to block their ability to repair their DNA. Cancer cells are very smart. They will adapt and they will find ways to repair their DNA. They will find ways to gain their own blood supply and feed themselves. They will find a way to evade the immune system. And these are such complex mechanisms at play at all times. So it's not just one thing going on at once. But we know that if the cancer cell is able to repair itself, it's going to continue to thrive. So PARP inhibitors have been developed in BRCA positive patients in order to stop that DNA repair in abnormal cancer cells. Lastly, we're almost about done. I wanted to give a slide on immunotherapy and breast cancer. Immunotherapy has made headlines and everyone's heard about immunotherapy. And it's really changed the way we treat cancer of all types. And it has come into the breast cancer arena, mostly in triple negative breast cancers at the moment who have advanced disease. But what is immunotherapy? Immunotherapy is not chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is a medication that we give that goes into the bloodstream and does not know the difference between a cancer cell and a normal cell. So it attacks everything. And therefore the toxicities of chemotherapy are related to that. Immunotherapy is different. Immunotherapy is designed to go into the bloodstream and wake up our immune system and get our T cells to be activated so that they can say, wait a minute, there's a tumor cell right next to me. I need to kill it. So this is a schematic here that looks at the T cell, which has a T cell receptor, and the tumor cell, which also has a receptor called the MHC. Now the tumor cells are smart because they design themselves to lock in with the T cell and therefore inactivate it. And therefore the T cell does not recognize that there's a tumor next door and does not kill it. So how do we get around this? Well, we've developed agents now that are blocking the ability of the tumor cell to bind to the T cell. So we have anti-PD-L1 therapy, which are antibodies that are given intravenously that basically will bind to the receptor on the tumor cell. And we also have anti-PD-1 antibodies, which are antibodies that bind to the T cell receptor itself, so that this cannot occur. Therefore, the T cell is free to circulate and go through immune surveillance and recognize those tumor cells and kill them. So this is really a great advancement. And we also have a way to predict who would be sensitive to this medication and who won't. There are ways to identify whether or not the patients have PD-L1 expression on their tumor cells. So that helps us to identify patients who may be sensitive to this type of therapy. So myths and facts. I'm going to go through some of these myths. There are a lot of myths out there. I'm only 35. Breast cancer happens only in older women. That is not true. While the risk of breast cancer does increase with age, all women are at risk for getting breast cancer. Remember the 1 in 8 number. Women with family history of breast cancer are the ones who typically get breast cancer. That's not true. As we said earlier, most women who get breast cancer have no family history of the disease. Again, more spontaneous breast cancers than hereditary breast cancers. Women with one or more risk factors are the ones who typically get cancer. That's not true also. The majority of women diagnosed with breast cancer have no known risk factors outside of their gender, and all women are at risk. And another myth, if I've had a mammogram every year, I would be exposed to too much radiation and that would cause cancer. That's not true. The small level of radiation from mammograms is believed to be safe, with the benefits outweighing the risks. So breast cancer prevention. We need to educate about breast cancer prevention and speak in communities and have people understand what can be done to prevent it in the first place, because that would be the best thing, is to modify risk factors like reducing or eliminating alcohol consumption, maintaining an ideal body weight, exercising on a regular schedule, obviously staying away from all contraceptives if possible, avoiding exposure to exogenous estrogens. And there are several drugs that have been studied as chemo preventative agents, usually used in patients who have been biopsied and found to have high risk lesions that are not turned cancerous yet. There are things like tamoxifen and raloxifen, which are used to prevent in these patients. but the only mature data from clinical trials is tamoxifen for chemo prevention. So remember that 1 in 8 women in the United States will still develop breast cancer in their lifetime. We hope to get this number down. So breast cancer, education, awareness, self-exam, going to your doctor, doing your screening are all very important and vital parts of reducing the mortality from breast cancer and obviously prevalence of breast cancer. And so we take this month of October to do a lot of this, but we educate our patients throughout the year and make sure that patients are screened appropriately and going to their doctor visits. So I thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate your time. And if there's any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Alreda. If anybody has any questions, you can put them in the chat and we will address them. One question actually did come up. So I wanted to ask you, you had spoken before when you showed a chart of mammography, there was one thing at the bottom that said biennially. Is there any, but then there was some, there wasn't some clarity about that. So at when after age 40, what are the givens of getting mammography? Every year forever or?
Yeah, so it is recommended to get a yearly mammogram for the average patient with no known risk factors and no family history of breast cancer. It would be yearly up until, we think that the patient has a life expectancy that maybe they'll die of a different cause than breast cancer itself. So, we have women who are very highly functional in 70s, 80s, who are healthy and are coming into our office. And I don't see a reason why they couldn't get a mammogram. There are patients who stop doing it on their own, but if they have comorbidities and they are frail and elderly and they have other things that may put them at risk for death from other causes, then maybe we can stop the mammography sooner. The biannual exam is used in certain circumstances. For example, if there is an abnormality or an asymmetry or some sort of cyst that is seen on an ultrasound or mammogram that the radiologist feels needs a closer follow-up, we would do a 6-month follow-up in those patients. Otherwise, in patients with no palpable abnormalities or breast complaints with a normal mammography, it would be yearly.
Okay, so yearly. And the other question is, how often do you recommend self-exams?
I recommend self-exams at least once a month. And, I usually tell women who are premenopausal not to do it during their menses. Sometimes during the menstruation phase, the breasts tend to get tender and swollen. So maybe to wait after the period and do the breast exam once the menstruation is over.
Okay. Another question. Latino women who present with BRCA, I'm not sure what the question is. If there are people who had ancestors who escaped Spain in the 1400s and they were originally Jewish, is that an issue, a different issue for BRCA? That might not be within the purview here.
Well, I don't know exactly, the 1400s, a long time ago. But, anyone who knows their family history, I mean, if they are Ashkenazi Jewish descent, or they know that there's someone in their family who's had BRCA, they need to be tested. I mean, these are patients who are high risk. So knowing your family history is really important. And unfortunately, nowadays people really don't know where they came from or, where their ancestors came from and don't have that family history. They may not know what people have died of before. But if you do know that information, it's best to bring it forward because then it enables us to do a better workup for that patient. And obviously, age counts too. Even if you don't have a family history, if you're presenting at a younger age, you may have the BRCA mutation. And we do test for those patients. And we've gone over some of the scenarios where you would test for it anyway.
Okay. Well, I think that about covers our questions. I want to thank Dr. Alreda so much. The recording of this program will be sent out later today. So we want to thank everybody for attending and thank New York Presbyterian Hospital for presenting this program, and Dr. Alreda spending her, I'm sure, a very, very busy day spending with us. We thank you so much.
Next
week, we'll be continuing the program with Changing Your Space to Age in Place with Faggy Horowitz on Tuesday, and another program on Rediscover and Relocate with other options for living in other places. That will be on Thursday as a pre-recording, but you'll be getting all that in emails to, you know, so you'll know how to do that. I want to remind everyone again that November 10th and 12th, we will be having presentations on Kristallnacht and Veterans Day. So we're going to confirm all that next week. So if you do want to participate with a personal presentation, please let me know in a few days. Have a great day, everyone. Have a good Shabbos. Be safe and healthy. Thank you so much for joining us.